cause I'll beat you to a pulp. Smiles to stickle in my uncertainty shape. Rolling in the shadows. Rolling in the gutter. Rolling in the shadows.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Welcome to Labor Radio on KBOO Portland. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilland.
Thank you so much for joining us. Just quickly before we jump into our main discussion topic today, we'd like to give a special thanks and shout out to the Labor Radio Podcast Network for hosting podcasted versions of our show each month. So be sure to check that out at laborradionetwork.org for archived podcasted versions of this show, as well as many other labor-related podcasts out there. And so now the main topic that we're going to be discussing today is we're coming back around to an issue that we've discussed many times, specifically about the gig economy and the exploitation of workers who are classified as contractors versus employees. There is a bit of pretty big development in this arena over the last few weeks. In a video of a December 14th fireside chat with Swiss bank UBS, which was made public by Lee Fong of The Intercept, Uber's CEO admitted that the company can easily afford to implement labor protections for workers and to reclassify their contractors to employees if they're forced to do so, which is something that they, you know, have adamantly insisted they cannot do. You know, the company has previously claimed that an employment model would force it to fire upwards of 75% of its U.S. drivers. But on last month's call, the CEO, Dara Khosrowshahi, said, and this is a quote from him, "We can make any model work. We really can, because our marketplace is incredibly flexible. There's a lot of demand for our technology, our service, our brand, our safety, our reliability. So any model can work economically for us. This is about what our drivers want and what couriers want, and they want flexibility. So we would very much prefer it to be because they prefer it." Now, that's kind of a skirt around. You know, he's saying really we just want what our drivers want. But, you know, and sure, like there are definitely there is a segment of all the drivers for those companies, such as Uber and Lyft and DoorDash and all those things, that do enjoy the flexibility of it. But there's a much larger segment of them that wish they had more protections that would be afforded to them if they were employees versus contractors in which they don't have any health benefits or any type of pension and are on the hook to pay for all the costs on their vehicle and, you know, wear and tear and things like that.
I think too, for me, this reminds me a lot of a couple of like two specific different scenarios where, you know, we are told kind of how a group of people feel without really actually hearing from them, because obviously, you know, Uber would not like there to be any sort of union for their drivers. In particular, this reminds me of kind of, hey, you know, fast food workers are all high schoolers, and so they enjoy the ability to kind of get their hours and then they move on, and no one's supposed to do this, when, you know, really we've discovered that the case is almost entirely the opposite, that people sit there for a really long time. And you know, I think the underneath the guise of kind of flexibility, we've also lost things in the past. You know, we haven't talked a whole lot about 401ks and pensions on this program, you know, but one of the ways that there was a general shift in America away from pensions to 401ks was under this kind of flexibility, you know, being able to bring it wherever you want. When originally they weren't really created to replace pensions at all, it was more to kind of it was more to be used alongside them. So I think these flexibility talking points, we've seen them used in the past. And typically, unless I'm hearing it from the folks that are being talked about, it's not always something that I buy.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, yeah, exactly like you were saying with, you know, 401ks versus pensions and, you know, the fast food worker area. Like, this is a trope that gets rolled out over and over again by, you know, as you said, the folks who are making the decisions from the top and who benefit from continuing to have workers, you know, in quote unquote flexible situations versus, you know, more static situations as employees. But more, you know, much more rarely do you hear it from the actual workers themselves. They would like fewer protections and less benefits and things like that, you know. This admission was made, you know, this whole situation came about in an effort to calm investors' concerns over potential new EU legislation, European Union, that would be cracking down on what they deemed fake self-employment, which I think is an incredible term for what sort of, you know, a gig employee is. It's not, you know, flexible. It's not, you know, independent contractor. They are just fake self-employed, because really they do work for a company and they have to follow all the regulations, and they are, you know, they may have flexibility over their hours, but, you know, the amount of money that they make, it makes them work more hours and you know, all those things. It really does give you a sense of faux self-employment. This legislation would require gig companies to designate drivers as employees or to provide contractors with additional pensions. It would also ensure gig workers are not exempt from minimum wage laws, and that they are provided access to sick pay, holidays, and other employment rights. And of course, on top of that, the legislation also includes a provision to ensure workers would have the right to receive explanations for and to contest automated decisions. In order to stop situations where workers are denied jobs, working hours, or are even fired as the result of machines' algorithmic decisions, which, you know, I, having not actually worked one of these jobs, I didn't actually realize that was part of it, but it does make sense that, you know, if you're based on, if your performances, or, you know, if your job status is based on a rating that you get, and then that is sort of run through the it's all compiled through the system, and the algorithm just determines whether or not you're still a good driver or not, that does seem like there's probably a lot there that drivers would question whether or not, you know, they were getting accurately evaluated by people, you know, their rides or their, you know, the people they're delivering to, and whether it seems like they should be able to have the right to contest that with an actual human. Which, you know, luckily enough, under this provision, companies would also have to ensure access to a human contact for anything that would have a significant impact on a person's employment status or working conditions. So I take that to mean that they would actually have a human representative they could discuss these changes with, versus just like the computer telling them that they're no longer employed or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, in addition to, I don't think a lot of people think about it, but the algorithm also controls how much money they make in a month because of the surge pricing and these sorts of things as well. And obviously that doesn't exactly fit into this category, but, you know, month to month, there's a lot of, you know, different algorithms and kind of automated processes that are determining huge portions of kind of what's going on in their day-to-day life. And I think pay is a pretty significant one to have be controlled by, you know, or not being able to talk to a human about it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, that's something that, I mean, obviously, again, having not done one of these jobs, you don't really think about. But of course, I mean, really, in a way, the part of the entire company that is probably the most important element, you know, beyond the actual individual drivers or like, you know, people in the corporate offices, is the algorithm they've created that determines all these things and sort of runs the way that, you know, whether when they do search pricing and all that stuff. And so that's kind of what, that's like the proprietary element that these companies like Uber and Lyft really hold tightly to. And that's why they think that they can, for the most part, they deserve, despite the fact that they haven't yet turned a profit, they deserve to be valued super highly because they've developed these specific algorithms, I suppose. But yeah, of course, if you're a human on the other end of that, on the sort of the receiving end of those decisions, when you don't have a direct boss you're discussing this with, you don't have any office you go into or an HR representative, you just have an app, and you have an app telling you whether or not you are still, you know, whether how much you're going to make for each ride or whether or not you're still able to receive rides and things like that, that can be really frustrating. And that's, of course, something that workers would want to get under control and actually have a human contact they can talk to. And, you know, the Guardian newspaper estimates that in the EU, there's 27 member states of the European Union, and within those, you know, within the entire union, there are about 5.5 million workers that are misclassified as self-employed when they actually should be treated as employees with benefits and protections. So they are, you know, as they described earlier, they are fake self-employed. Now, the proposal that is coming forth in the EU, the piece of legislation, is an attempt to provide legal certainty. After many European courts have been asked to settle about 100 disputes relating to gig economy companies. And the, sort of the main driver of it comes from a decision back in August from Spain that where they enacted what they call the Rider Law, which requires gig food delivery companies to classify drivers as employees. So that's sort of the main impetus for this. But of course, on top of that, there are other countries such as France, Italy, Greece, and Portugal that have all recently tightened up their domestic laws surrounding gig work. And, you know, they have definitely made specific court decisions in each one of those countries regarding this type of work. But EU officials still believe that no member state's government has fully addressed the problem. And so that's why they're putting forth this piece of, you know, fully federation-wide legislation that would force these companies to reclassify their workers. And even in the United Kingdom, which since the Brexit decision is no longer required to follow European Union law, the UK's Supreme Court last year upheld a 2016 employment court ruling that Uber drivers are not self-employed and therefore should be paid the minimum wage. So, you know, even outside, you know, even in the satellite states that are, you know, impacted by the EU but are not directly part of it, this type of legislation is having an impact, and we are seeing that sort of ripple out. Now, of course, the decision in the UK meant that Uber was forced to reclassify 70,000 workers within the United Kingdom, which is no small amount for them to have to completely reclassify. And a representative of the European Trade Union Confederation said the new legislation should signal, and this is a quote, should signal the end of the free-for-all for companies such as Uber. Which, you know, of course, yeah, like these companies have basically changed the landscape of the industries in which they work, you know, specifically Uber and of course Lyft and companies like that, completely changed the landscape of like our personal transportation, and, you know, eliminated cabs from so many places, and, you know, took business away from public transport and things like that. And it really has been, at this point, there have been attempts, you know, in different cities and states to regulate them, but for the most part, it has been a free-for-all. They have been able to just come in and completely rewrite the rules everywhere they go because of the demand for their service and because of their money and their size and their power and things like that. And so, of course, this would be a major step in the you know, in backtracking in the right direction in favor of workers. And of course, yeah, as he said, it would signal an end to the free-for-all. And this representative went on to say that for too long, platform companies have made huge profits by dodging their most basic obligations as employers, and at the expense of workers, while peddling the lie that they provided choice to workers, which of course is sort of what we were discussing earlier, that it has been on the back of this, you know, often rolled out lie of like flexibility and worker choice that, you know, is often, you know, peddled by the people at the top who make the decisions, but it's very rarely something that you hear echoed by the people actually doing the work who have the, quote, you know, choice to make these employment decisions. And so along with that, George Mayer, who is a specialist on digital technology at the London School of Economics, said in relation to this this potential legislation, he said, for a lot of these platforms, because they're realizing their model is not profitable, there's a big question over what change they can do and what change they can't do. We've seen some evidence of platforms trying to get around the tightened grip of legislation by changing their business model, because the alternative is to pull out of a country where they don't see a profitable future. And so for you know, a company like Uber and Lyft and all the other companies that would be affected by this type of legislation, the EU is such a major marketplace. You know, it's not just one individual member state, and it's not just one individual city, but it is the entire federation, the entire European Union, which again is 27 countries, countries in which they are largely, you know, they are countries that have large middle classes and places like that where people actually use these services. And so for them, you know, for Uber to just pull out of the entire EU is kind of insane, and that of course would not happen. So obviously the choice on their part is to likely going to be to switch their employment, you know, switch the model by which they relate to their workers, you know, so to make them employees versus contractors. And so that kind of all gets back around to the fact that, you know, this is one of those things that they have been telling us for a long time could not happen, and yet now it will be forced to happen. And on top of that, you know, Uber's CEO, like, his nonchalance towards potentially changing Uber's entire European employment model is quite shocking when you compare that to, you know, like, to how they've been dealing with workers in the United States. And, you know, like, we've discussed this many times, but, like, this is kind of the defining factor of this era, specifically, you know, surrounding the growth of the tech sector and the gig economy, is how to deal with these employees, or, you know, employees versus contractors. And so this decision, or this comment from Uber's CEO about the ease with which they could change the employment model, stands in stark contrast to the company's petulant opposition to such legislation in the United States, where the classification of gig workers has become one of the most contentious labor issues of the 21st century at this point. You know, so just for some context, in the United States, there's an estimated 59 million total gig workers working within the United States, and though they work without benefits, without guaranteed hours, or without the protection of a union. And Uber itself, like that specific company, has been a leading force in the fight to preserve, you know, the quote-unquote gig employment model within the U.S. Now we did multiple episodes on this topic, in the year 2020 and 2021. But you may, if you're listening from California, or even if you're just sort of aware of, you know, these issues, you may have heard of Prop 22, which was a major ballot initiative in the state of California. And the Uber themselves individually poured over $190 million into the successful Prop 22 campaign, which of course made it so that these gig workers, you know, the people that work for these companies, would remain as contractors and not be forced to be made employees. On top of that, Uber itself is also currently spending millions on advocacy to enshrine independent contractor status laws for drivers in Illinois, Massachusetts, New York, the other states that have considered gig labor reform, labor model. And before I continue discussing this, just want to reintroduce everyone to the show, just take a little break here and let folks know that you are tuning in to Labor Radio on KBOO Portland, and we are discussing recent comments from the CEO of Uber about how it would actually be quite easy for the company to switch their employment model from contractor to employee, despite the fact that they have publicly been fighting such a change in the United States for years now, for basically their entire existence. And yeah, so we're going to continue discussing that topic here.
I think the comments too, I mean, clearly there's not really been a change in viewing of employment status at Uber or at Lyft or at these other companies. But, you know, we mentioned earlier, it really was a stock price play in order to kind of make sure that people, you know, didn't, the stock price didn't fall in response to, you know, this specific piece of EU legislation. So really, I mean, this doesn't, to me, show any sort of shift in kind of the internal mentality within Uber or that money's going to be stopped spent on this. It was really to protect stock price.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, you're 100% right, because this, the admission from the CEO, as Ellie just said, came from a investor call with the bank UBS. It was not a public statement. In fact, the video of that was leaked to The Intercept. So it was not something that the CEO thought he was making public, and it was not a change in the company's policy, but rather just, you know, it was kind of a mask off moment in the way that he was discussing the, or calming fears of investors, which to a certain degree, you know, obviously a company has, you know, internal and external communication, but more often than not, they will probably be more upfront with the people who are, you know, their investors and funding them than they would with their workers. And so if this is something that he's admitting that they could do, then that means that that's definitely possible, despite the fact that likely means they won't do anything about it in the United States. It'll only be when they are forced to, such as what the EU is doing. But the fact that it is, that they have, you know, said the quiet part loud, and they have admitted that this is something they could easily do without doing anything to even, you know, it would have no impact on the their people's, these people's investment in the company at all, is pretty telling, you know. Now, for his part, Kasra Shahi, the CEO of Uber, he himself even proposed, you know, so this is just going back to how they've been fighting the change, you know, the attempts to change the employment model in the United States. Now, of course, yeah, I mentioned they poured over $190 million into the successful Prop 22 campaign. And they are currently fighting the legislation, you know, the proposed legislation in states all around the country. But on top of that, the CEO himself even proposed that the company should have temporarily suspended its services throughout the entire state of California in protest over the passage of California Assembly Bill 5, which was the predecessor to Prop 22. It was basically assembly bill, a piece of legislation in the state of California that aimed to make gig workers eligible for minimum wage, union membership, and healthcare benefits, which was passed. And then Prop 22, once that was voted in by, you know, as a ballot measure by voters, it basically nullified all the elements of that assembly bill that was in fact passed by the California State Assembly. But like, you know, the fact that they were so against the idea of changing the employment model that they even threatened to like throw a temper tantrum and just suspend all of their services in the most populous state in the country tells you a lot about like sort of what their position is. Yeah,
totally. And I think we can guarantee you that it wasn't in defense. It wasn't $190 million in defense of workers' flexibility.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. Like they weren't just throwing down $190 million to like really prove that they care about workers' choice and that they really are fighting for their workers to have the right to choose their own schedules and things like that. It was very clearly done in a self-interested way of like, how do we preserve the largest amount of profits that we know we get from this model versus the model of actually taking care of our the people who do all the work for us. They did not just throw down, you know, close to $200 million just to prove that they care about their workers. You know, that was that would never really happen. Now, you know, of course, like all this has to be, you know, the fact that we're discussing the EU and the changes of the employment model there, and the fact that he said it's something they could do in the United in response to EU legislation. It is good to note, or you know, it's important to note that employer costs for employee benefits tend to be higher in the United States than they do in Europe, largely because of the failed social safety net that we have in this country. But you know, it's largely because of the United States system of employer provided health coverage versus in the EU. I mean, I you know, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but I'm fairly certain that every single one of the EU member states has some form of public health care system, whether or not it's something as, you know, as wide ranging as like the NHS in the UK, or if it's, you know, a little bit more of that like public private thing that they have going on in France. But you know, all of these countries have basically taken the burden of providing health care off, you know, health insurance off of the employer, so the employer no longer has to deal with that because the state provides that for their workers. So the overall cost of transitioning an employee to, you know, from contractor where they are not provided any benefits to employee where they are then provided, you know, benefits and protections is certainly lower in the EU than it would be in the United States, because they don't have to deal with the thing that is the most expensive, which is healthcare costs. But, you know, as we discussed earlier, like, the political environment is also much more favorable to workers in Europe at this point than it is in the United States. In Europe, you know, as a result of, or not as a result of, but like as evidenced by all the different pieces of legislation and court rulings that have happened around the individual member states, the tides have clearly shifted recently, and they have turned, you know, they have turned and left the courts and elected officials far more aligned with labor interests. And that is obviously clear in, you know, in the example of them trying to put forward this wide, you know, sweeping federation-wide legislation. But, you know, that is, you know, that's in stark contrast to how in the United States they were basically in, you know, what is, quote, you know, the most progressive state, California, the most populous state. Companies like Uber and Lyft were able to just pull the wool over voters' eyes and get them to vote, you know, in a pretty wide margin for Prop 22, which was actively actively undermining the interests of the workers for those companies in that state. And, you know, of course, the fact that we have that type of legislation, you know, Prop 22 style legislation spreading into other state houses around the country, and the fact that the Democratic Party on a federal level hasn't done much to even protect those workers or trying to enshrine that interest. You know, there's been no movement towards trying to pass the PRO Act or anything like that. So it's very clear that in, you know, despite the fact that Europe might not be the most progressive place in, you know, or at least in, you know, in this moment versus its history, it is clearly more on the side of workers, or at least more willing to take steps to help workers than any government is in the United States, unfortunately. And, you know, despite Uber's public outrage over Spain's rider law, which is sort of what kicked all of this off, and the similar proposed legislation throughout Europe, which they've even gone so far as to deploy a team of lobbyists to the EU headquarters in Brussels in an attempt to kill this legislation that we're discussing. But yeah, just, you know, despite all that, on the investor call with UBS, Uber's CEO noted that the company's Spanish business is up close to 40% on a year-on-year basis. And even with the enhanced worker protections in place, that's still the case. So, you know, again, kind of saying the quiet part loud on that investor call, but that despite, you know, their public protestations over this type of shift, they're still seeing their profits increase in Spain that has already required them to reclassify their workers. So again, it's very clear that these companies could afford to do that and it would not really hurt their bottom line very much, but it's more of a principled stand. It's more of a, you know, largely why they make this decision and why they fight these types of legislation so hard is to ensure that there will be no type of, you know, no progress towards this at all in the future, so they can preserve their maximal profit-seeking business model moving forward without any encumbrance to that. Now, you know, for labor advocates in the United States, all of this just falls in line with what we've always known about Uber and, you know, similar companies. Uber specifically, you know, labor advocates in the United States see a company that can unequivocally do more for their workers when forced to comply with legislation, but will stop at nothing to maximize profit for executives and shareholders. And, you know, to kind of hammer that home, Steve Smith, who is a spokesperson for the California Labor Federation, said in a recent interview with The Intercept that Uber has always said it couldn't adapt to an employee model that afforded its drivers fundamental protections in law like a minimum wage and a right to form a union. But the CEO's acknowledgement of that that the company can and has adapted to treating workers as employees in other countries is a slap in the face to every single driver in the United States that Uber continues to exploit. It boils down to pure greed of wealthy executives who will do anything in their power to lock workers out of having a share of the profits that their labor creates. And so, you know, we're kind of running up against the clock here, so we're gonna have to shut this conversation down. But it is important to note that, like, if this does get passed, if this legislation does get passed in the EU, and these companies, instead of pulling out, just shift their employment model, then despite the fact that, you know, all the things we discussed about the differences between the United States and the EU, it would still prove that these companies could operate under an employment model versus a contractor model, and would give more fodder for kits of, you know, labor advocates in the United States to lawmakers to force them to do so, because it proved that legislation is what forced their hand in the EU. So the similar approach would surely work in the United States. Yeah, we're going to have to leave it there. We will obviously keep an eye on this and see what happens moving forward with Uber in the EU. And we will bring that back to you as that story develops. But thank you so much for tuning in to Labor Radio. We will be back with you next month. And again, I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilland.
Have a great evening.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening. You're listening to Prison Pipeline here on KBOO Community Radio. We have a very special guest here tonight. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi, everyone. My name is Terry Robinson. I'm an inmate here on North Carolina's death row, and I've been here for 20